I've entitled this seminar Hope and Help, because you'll find it unlike any other grief seminar that you may ever have attended before. Today we're going to start with a study in understanding the grief process, then we'll continue where the other seminars leave off. We'll secondly look at helping a grieving friend, both from the caring and from the practical points of view. And then just before our question time, we will also share some practical advice on self-help for the grieving. Tonight's seminar, last night's one on death, tonight's seminar is a very practical program. Grief is one of the most common experiences of man. We experience it not only in relation to death, but in relation to any experience of loss. Gary Collins in How to Be a People Helper defines it simply as an important normal response to the loss of any significant object or person. Indeed, whenever a part of life is removed, there is grief. We encounter it following many of life's experiences. Divorce, retirement, a child leaving home, loss of a cherished object, hysterectomy, the birth of a handicapped child, even being dismissed from work. But death, however, is for many the most difficult to cope with. Grief is a normal human response to loss. It's important for us to grieve, to do our grief work, for it is work, and it's painful and slow and repetitive. As people in sorrow work through their grief, they tend to follow a pattern which follows several stages. A normal grief reaction involves the person progressing naturally through all or most of these stages, and by this work, eventually returning to the mainstream of life, adjusted to their new situation. However, an abnormal or morbid grief reaction is equally possible, where a person will not do their grief work or is diverted from their task by well-meaning people trying to help in the wrong way. We were going to talk about this later on when we talk about helping a grieving friend. For this reason, we need to know something of the normal process in which people go through as they face their loss and deal with it. Granger Westberg in Good Grief suggested 10 stages that people are likely to go through in grieving. This is an expansion of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's material on death and dying. She outlined a lesser number of stages, and I think this particular list is probably a little more practical and more easy to comprehend. Of course, we must remember that a person doesn't necessarily go through these stages in any particular order. And you can't always differentiate clearly between the stages, because you see, a person doesn't neatly move from one stage to another. Let's look at the overhead. Number one, we are in a state of shock. Shock is a temporary escape from reality. Our nature allows the reality of the loss to slowly sink in. Shock and denial help us to absorb it without being overwhelmed. We may feel faint or feel nothing but numbness and move like a robot for a day or two. Actually, some people surprise their friends by acting as if the loss had never happened. Well, this normally provides a sort of built-in space that enables the person to get their act together. And we as friends should not rush the griever through this stage, nor encourage them to linger. Stage two, we express emotion. In this stage, the expressing of feelings is foremost, paramount. Emotional release comes about the time it begins to dawn upon how dreadful this loss is. For many, the pain felt is expressed through tears and wailing, anger, rage, and violent outbursts of words or actions. Repetitive activity, like making cups of tea over and over. Laughter and talkativeness are ways of letting tense feelings out. We friends need to help the person to get these feelings out without stifling them, and yet helping them to feel safe as they do so. The person's tears or anger may often frighten them, so they need lots of support and encouragement. Stage three, we feel depressed and lonely. Eventually there comes a feeling of utter depression and isolation. It's as if God is no longer in his heaven, as if God doesn't care. It is in these days that we are sure that no one else has ever grieved as we are grieving. In their depression, people sometimes say things that are irrational and even treat people who are trying to care for them badly. But at this time, when they feel isolated and forsaken, they need the quick presence of friends whose loyalty and availability persists as a constant reminder that they are not really alone. Stage four. We may experience physical symptoms of distress. At this stage, our grief is often expressed through body reactions. Severe grief disturbs not only our thinking and feeling, but all our body rhythms are upset to some degree. Our natural patterns of sleeping, eating, going to the toilet, menstruation, breathing, heartbeat, they may be disturbed. We are likely to be more susceptible to infection and disease. If the grieving person bottles things up, we can increase stress on our bodies and be seriously hurt. They will right themselves, but we may go through physical discomfort. While some physical problems at this time are basically psychosomatic, they are often real and do need actual treatment as physical problems. Grieving too is an exhausting business, and the worn out person is more susceptible to picking up an illness that their system, when healthy, would normally be immune to. It's a great relief for people to know that such experiences are, for many, a normal part of the coping process. In stage five, we may become panicky. We find ourselves becoming panicky because we can think of nothing but the loss, often beginning with an inability to concentrate. Many feel, "I'm losing my mind." And a vicious circle is built up of not coping because of panic, and then panicking because of not coping. A tremendous relief is often experienced when a person, paralyzed with fear, comes to understand something of the grief process and the tricks that grief can play on our mind. Above all, they need friends who will affirm them as being normal. Being a normal person. Stage number six. We feel a sense of guilt about the loss. Feeling guilt is almost a permanent part of the grieving process. Sometimes it is true guilt, But very often it's neurotic, false guilt. And sometimes the two are intertwined. Often guilt feelings lead to a variety of bothersome defense mechanisms that can wreck relationships, cause strife, and leave people with real regret for what they do if they handle these real feelings inappropriately. For this reason, it's so helpful for the person to verbalize their guilt feelings. Some areas of false guilt will evaporate as they see the revealing light of day. Real sins can be owned and dealt with properly, and unresolved guilt or misunderstood emotions can make us feel miserable for years. Or they may come out in a variety of physical symptoms of distress. Stage 7, we are filled with hostility and resentment. Gradually, as we move out of depression with its associated guilt feelings, we may be more able to express some feelings of hostility and resentment which we may not even be aware of them. Expressing these feelings is important. While grief can be a healthy emotion, hostility and resentment are definitely not, even if the person has had a rough deal. Grieving people should not be encouraged to be hostile or resentful. However, if they're repressed, they do not go away, but will take over the subconscious and do terrible damage to the person. If you get an opportunity, make sure you come to our seminar, Anger and Conflict Resolution. Or you may be interested in obtaining the cassette tapes of those seminars. Stage 8. We are unable to return to normal activities. Something holds us back. You know, apathy is often a part of our experience at this stage. And sadly, people often get to this stage when everyone else has got on with living. And the grieving person, once overwhelmed with care and company, sees no one for days on end. Of course, wise friends will plan ahead to do normal daily activities with their grieving friend when the initial shock has worn off and they're trying to readjust to a new and sometimes frightening situation. A time to do things with people rather than for them. Also at this stage, that idealism and idealization is foremost. We hold to the past and revere it as the best. Feelings are usually calmer now, but we can feel convinced that life can never be as good as again. I'll never find such a friend again. Or I can never really be happy again. Or he was a perfect son. When a person's energy is locked up into what they had, there is none available to develop the future. Stage 9, gradually hope comes through. If we've not been hindered in our grieving work, then gradually we get a little glimpse of hope in one experience or another. There's no set time for grief, and no people ever respond the same way. Nor are any two grief situations identical. But grief normally takes time. However, when an accepting environment is provided and a person is encouraged to do their grief work properly, there will be more breaks in the clouds for the grieving person and normal life will resume sooner. And finally, stage 10. Eventually, we work through our grief and life goes on again. This final stage is not we become our old selves again, When we go through any significant grief experience, we come out again as different people, depending, of course, on the way we respond to the event. We're either stronger people than they were before or weaker, either healthier in spirit or sicker. Psalm 84:6, the psalmist tells of the wise men going through the vial of misery and using it as a well. Some will do that. Others need proper help with their grieving, and not getting it will drown in misery instead. Stage 10. New patterns begin to emerge. With much of the disruption behind us, we start to make new routines, focus on new thinking. We find there are new reasons for getting up in the morning and going on with everyday living. Now we come to what is really the major area in which your caring is needed, and that is when people are suffering loss. I promised this would be a practical seminar. Well, let's get on with it. When people suffer loss, you know, no doubt at this very moment, a number of people around you are facing this very problem, loss. It's also very possible that they are getting very little or no help. We usually notice grief caused by death. However, it's vital to know that grief is a necessary necessity. How the person works through it will determine whether it leaves them damaged or not. Of course, as I said before, loss comes in many different ways. A child leaving home for college, breakup of a romance, the death of a loved one, redundancy, separation, divorce. Each of these situations can bring a sense of grief. Each stirs up feelings of emptiness, loneliness, sense of bewilderment. How do we care for people who are feeling an acute sense of loss? Let's start with a few useful principles that other lay people have found helpful in assisting people to face loss. Number one, help them to admit that they feel a sense of loss. People can never overcome a problem until they admit that they have one. Number two, show them that it is not a weakness to lean on others at such a time. Actually, you could tell them of times when you could not have coped without leaning on someone who cared. Assure them that you care, and that your care is not given grudgingly, but joyously. And make sure that's a fact, or get some help yourself. Number three, encourage them not to make any major decisions at the moment. Some people rebound at times of loss and try to compensate for the sense of loss by rushing prematurely into new commitments, buying a smaller house, moving in with relatives, going on a holiday, giving all the estate money away to family and friends. And number four, help them to see the need for a lot of rest, a regular schedule, and a proper diet. This mightn't seem like deep spiritual advice, but it really is. In fact, there's a little phrase, two-word phrase that has been coined, which may be appropriate to mention here. I'll put it on an overhead for you. It says, new start. And it's actually an acronym for nutrition, exercise, water, sunshine, temperance, air, rest, and trust in God. If you can help the grieving person to see their need for each of these, then they can have a new start. Balanced nutrition, appropriate exercise, to drink plenty of water, to have a moderate amount of sunshine, to be temperate in all things, to get plenty of fresh air, plenty of rest, even though sleep is sometimes elusive, and always to trust in God. We'll just move back to our original overhead, helping a grieving friend. Remember I said we had to help them to admit the loss, to tell them it's okay to lean on others, to encourage them, no major decisions, to make sure they have rest, a regular schedule and proper diet, and finally we come to number 5, to make yourself available, daily if possible, so that the person can talk with you, pray with you, and share thoughts from the scriptures. At the same time as giving such help, it's helpful to also learn how not to care. There are certain pitfalls to caring. Don't take over or distract them from their work of dealing with their grief. It's possible to smother them with so much care that we negatively affirm the idea that they can't cope. I have another overhead here I'd like you to look at. It is entitled Pitfalls to Caring. 1 Corinthians 13:4 reads, verses 4 to 7, love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it's not proud, it is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Like all interpersonal relationships, when we are caring about and for another, there are often pitfalls and dangers. To be an effective carer, we must be aware of both the opportunities and the dangers. These are the things that make your caring a real ministry, and yet these are also the very things that will, if not guarded against, mar that same ministry of caring. Number 1. The first pitfall we shall examine is that of manipulation. We manipulate people when we try to control them or deny them their freedom. When attempting to help someone, you may long to see them to act upon your suggestions or implement your advice. You may grieve profoundly when they take an opposite direction, but you must never, never try to control that person or dominate them to the degree where they lose their freedom. To do so is to violate the person's autonomy, that's their personal responsibility to God for their decisions, and it ignores the fact that every person is a volitional being made in the image of God. Most people would, in principle, reject the moral attitude that the end justifies the means. They justifiably criticize groups such as the Nazis and the Communist parties for basing their morality on such principles. However, in practice, many folk, without realizing it, take exactly that attitude when it comes to trying to achieve what they believe is best for their grieving friend. A second pitfall for the person involved in helping ministry is over-curiosity. Caring, as we've seen, involves a high degree of closeness and intimacy. Sometimes it involves talking about deep personal problems such as one's attitudes, basic needs, inner feelings. We need to be careful we don't become involved in probing a person just to satiate our own curiosity. The caring ministry of many has been ruined because they allowed themselves to go beyond the bounds of propriety in their questioning and to meet their own needs rather than the needs of the person they were supposed to be helping. If you fail to recognize that caring can make you vulnerable to your own sinful tendencies and fantasies, and you do not commit yourself wholly to God's leading, you may indeed finish up hurting more people than you help. This is why, when intimate things need to be shared, such as a person's innermost secrets and their sacred feelings or sexual needs, it's prudent for men to help men and women to help women. Of course, this rule can sometimes be waived, as in the case of a pastor or a professional counsellor. But generally, it's a good rule to follow. The same Holy Spirit who motivates you to care can protect you from becoming over-curious or voyeuristic. Be ever watchful that your tendencies don't lead you into areas where you shouldn't go. I guess it's well to remember that good intentions are not enough. A third danger that confronts us when we become involved in the caring ministry is caring when care is not needed. Many of us know people who, having just started a first aid or nursing course, virtually try to recruit patients. Alternatively, they make an undue fuss about virtually minor matters, a simple wrist sprain and a sling and a scratch treated like a deep cut. Once again, this is someone meeting their own needs rather than relating to the rest, to the real needs of the other person. Equally, in caring for others, we can make similar errors in trying too hard to be the caring person. As you go home from this seminar and as you learn more skills and understand new ideas about caring, make sure you approach those you care about as persons and not objects to practice on. The desire to help others is good. In fact, I'd bold enough to say it's God-given. But you need more than desire. You must have a disciplined desire. Desire is the driving force that drives us forward in life, but desire has to be controlled with discipline. So we need to be firm with ourselves. A fourth pitfall is confronting the person involved in caring ministry by caring for too many at one time. Of course, this can be taken two ways: caring for too many different people at once, or having too many people that we feel responsible to care for. Both are equally dangerous positions to be in. Both situations have within them the power to negate all your good intentions. And ironically, the more you try to help, the less help you will be. Let me read from you from Gary Collins' book, The People Helper. He says, "Most of us have had the experience of reading articles or listening to speakers who dramatically picture human needs and then challenge us to reach out in ways that will eliminate injustice or change the world. Such pleas can arouse considerable guilt followed by frustration because there seems so little that one person can do. These are very wise words. Just as we're cautioned not to be over-enthusiastic, it's equally wise caution to care for one person at a time and care for them well. No one has been given the job of caring for the whole world. Our task is to care for the person near us who is in need. Jesus helped people one at a time. He preached to the multitudes and fed the thousands. But someone's pointed out that in the Gospels there are no fewer than 19 private conferences that Jesus had with people, thus illustrating the importance of helping people one at a time and concentrating on helping a few people well rather than giving half-baked care to a crowd. We're going to have a discussion time now. I have a discussion question here on the blackboard. What are the reasons why some people allow themselves to be overwhelmed by too many people depending on them for help? I'm going to break up into small groups and spend the next few moments. See then that becomes quite easy to do, doesn't it? Okay, let's move back to where we were. Remember we were talking about the pitfalls of caring, and we got to the fifth pitfall. This is possibly the most serious danger that confronts us in the caring ministry. Caring for others to the detriment of our own families. Sometimes this happens in the homes of ministers who allow the demands of their ministry to slowly erode away time spent with the family. Of course, the Christian church has in recent times been rocked by news of the breakup of marriages of the very people who's often spent their whole lives helping to people to sort out their marriage difficulties. One writer said, "Nothing is so pathetic as a dedicated Christian who's become so concerned in caring for other people that he or she has forgotten the family and lost the respect of people at home." You've heard the saying, charity begins at home. Providing a caring ministry to your family is yours and my first job. If you can't or won't do that, then it's pointless seeking more work to do. Bishop Timothy of Ephesus, in about 65 AD, was cautioned, "If a person know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the larger family?" 1 Timothy 3:5. The sixth pitfall that we confront as we exercise the ministry of caring is that of caring no longer than necessary. Think for a moment of those that have really helped you in your life. It's likely they were people who came alongside you, supported you long enough until you could stand on your own two feet, and then quietly withdrew. This is the ministry of caring by caring no longer than is necessary. Almost everyone has one thing in common about learning to ride a bicycle for the first time. We got on, pedaled forward, and promptly fell off. Then along came a helper, probably dad or big brother or sister. They held the bike upright as we concentrated on pedaling and holding onto the handlebars. After a few hours of running beside us, they eventually let go, but so often we ride along for 100 yards or so, quite unaware that we're doing it alone and doing it well. We may have fallen off when at last we realised that we were going solo, but from then on, we knew. This knowledge that we do have the ability to support ourselves was the key when we needed to become eventually independent of our helpers. And that's what happens in good caring. We come alongside the person for a while, hold on, and walk with them, so to speak, until we know that they can make it alone. Then eventually, we slowly let go, and the person goes on without our help. There's an old saying, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. One more peril which confronts us when we undertake the ministry of caring is caring without making sure of sufficient backup or support. I'm going to address this from a Christian perspective, simply because as a Christian I have a personal bias. However, these comments will nevertheless be reflective for all of us, and these can be applied to your own personal situation. There's no such thing as do-it-yourself Christianity. The message of the New Testament is that Christians should link themselves with other Christians so that they can give one another prayer and spiritual support. Popular advert on TV that's sponsored by a number of insurance companies says, you need the strength of assurance wrapped around you. It's not a bad message to those who want to discover life's greatest purpose and move into ministry of caring for which God has designed them, caring for those grieving around you. You need the strength of the church wrapped around you. Don't try to care for others without making sure that you have some strong spiritual backup in the prayers of the church, or at least a group in the church. From time to time you need people not only to pray for you, but to pray with you. Oh, there'll be times of failure, discouragement and difficulty, when the prayers of a close-knit group or fellowship can make all the difference. Many people do not have support groups simply because they tell themselves, without checking, nobody in my church seems concerned about others. Is that really so? Is it not too much to conclude that an omnipotent God can also lead you to others who can give and receive support which enhances your effectiveness in the body of Christ? It's also important to note that the church becomes what we intentionally set out to make it. We must set goals to make our church a caring church, and then use some of our time away from our immediate ministry to pay this greater dividend, far more than we invest. By so doing, it's going to release others to support us, so that we're not going to bear the heat of the day alone. Of course, it's also going to provide us with that support and resource base without which our ministry to others will eventually collapse. Of course, this leads us now to our final pitfall in caring, and that is the deceit of self-neglect. Oh, so dangerous and yet so common is this problem among people who are involved in caring for others, especially the grieving. You know, Satan fools Christian carers into this folly. He defeats our work while we often think that we're being pious and unselfish. Now, I know some of you came here tonight because you wanted me to talk specifically about some practical things that we can do to help a grieving friend. Most of us want to be helpful when grief strikes a friend, but often we don't know how. We may end up doing nothing because we don't know the helpful things to say and to do. Here are some specific suggestions. Number one, take an honest attitude. To the surprise of many good-intentioned helpers, this is more inclined to make your friend or neighbour feel worse when you say, "Come on now, back up. Don't take it so hard. Don't try them, buck them up." When someone's lost their husband or wife, it's natural and normal for them to take it hard. In such a situation, being bucked up makes a person feel you are minimizing his loss. But the honest attitude says, "Yes, it's tough. And I realize what you must be going through." Or if you don't realize, say, "I don't fully understand what you're going through." It makes the other person feel free to express their grief and to recover from it. The "don't take it so hard" approach can create wrong guilt feelings about grieving. It can deprive the person of natural emotion of grief and thereby stop this safety valve, grief, that God has given to them. Number two, don't try to divert them. Visit with a purpose. Many people visiting the bereaved purposely veer away from the subject. They make small talk about football, fishing, the weather, anything but the reason for the visit. This has been called camouflage. The task of the mourner, difficulties as it is to face the fact of death and to go on from there. Be far better to sit silently and say nothing than make obvious attempts to distract. The sorrowing friend sees through the effort to divert them, and when the visitor leaves, reality hits them all the harder. Number three, don't be afraid to talk about the person who has died. Well-intentioned friends will often shy away from mentioning the deceased. The implication is that the whole thing is too terrible to mention. The more helpful thing is to talk about the person as you knew him in the fullness of his or her life, to recreate a living picture to replace this picture of death. When visiting a woman whose brother had just died, a wise pastor simply said, "I didn't know your brother very well. Tell me about him." The woman started talking, and they discussed her brother for over an hour. After which she said, "I feel relieved now for the first time since he died." Number four, don't be afraid of causing tears. Tears are healing. Many people feel that they've really put their foot in it when, after saying something about the person who's died, have seen their eyes fill up. In actual fact, more often than not, they have helped their friend to express grief in a normal, healthy way. That's far better than to stifle grief when friends are present, only to have it descend more crushingly when they are alone. Fear of causing tears, probably more than anything else, makes people stiff and ineffective. Rather than mentioning anything closely related to the dead person, they talk about a wide range of irrelevant trivia. They are really depriving their friend of the greatest help they could give him, that is, to help him to experience grief in a normal way and to get over it. Expressing grief is good, repressing it is bad. If a comment of yours brings tears, remember they are healthy tears. Number five, let them talk. Sorrowing people need to talk. Friends worry a lot about saying the right thing. They should be more worried about the ability to listen. If the warmth of your presence can get your friend to start talking, then keep quiet and listen. Even though he or she may repeat the same thing a dozen times, they're not telling you news. They're expressing feelings that need repetition. If after your visit your friend has said 100 words to your one, you've helped a lot. The little saying I made up. When you share your care one to one, share your ear 100 to one. There's no such thing as I just wouldn't know what to say when you know how to listen. Number 6 is reassure, don't argue. Everybody who loses someone has some guilt feelings. They mightn't be justified, but they are natural. Husband feels he should have been more considerate of his wife. A parent feels they should have spent more time with the child. A wife feels she should have made fewer demands on her husband. The yearning, if only I had not done this or that. If only I had a chance to do it now. If only. Characteristic of normal grieving. These feelings must work their way out. If a person is wrong, verbalizing the feeling is probably the best way they can see it for themselves, that what they feel is not always realistic when exposed openly. If the guilt feelings are based on fact, it's far healthier for them to own up and thereby loosen their cancerous grip upon them. Above all, never say, "You don't really feel that way, do you?" The person's thereby encouraged to lie to you rather than deal adequately with mixed up feelings that need to be brought to the surface where they can eventually be sorted out. Number 7 is communicate, not isolate. Too often the one who's bereaved is overwhelmed with visitors for a week or so, and then the house is empty. Even good friends sometimes stay away, believing that people in sorrow like to be alone. There's nothing worse than such silent treatment. Not only have they lost their husband or wife, they've lost us too. It's in that after period when letters of sympathy have been read and acknowledged and people have swung back into the daily routine that friends are needed most. Keep in touch. See your friend more often than you did before. See him for any purpose, for lunch, a drive in the country, for shopping, for an evening visit. He suffered a great loss. Your job is to show him by implication how much he still has left. Your being with him is a tangible proof to him that he still has resources. Number 8. Perform some concrete act. For example, many times grieving people have lost their interest in food until a friend brought over a favourite dish or simply left it there for lunch. Such a concrete deed carries the immense implication that you care. We should make it our business when a friend is in sorrow to do at least one practical, tangible act of kindness. Here's some to choose from. Run errands with your car. Take the children to school. Bring in a meal. Do the dishes. Make necessary phone calls. Pick up the mail at the office. Help acknowledge condolence notes. shop for groceries. In fact, I read a few years ago about a lady who commented on the fact that when her husband died, the next door neighbour bustled into the house the day before the funeral and gathered up every pair of shoes she could find and busily and quietly cleaned them so that none in the household, including the children, could have an excuse for wearing dirty shoes to the funeral. This was an example of a concrete act. Just a few years ago, we had a devastating house fire which caused us the loss of almost all our possessions. And somebody who knew the family well but did not know the circumstances of the fire took it upon herself nevertheless, instead of coming to cry on our shoulders, came with a plastic shopping bag containing a roll of toilet paper, some toothbrushes and toothpaste, face washes and soap. Practical things we can do when people have a loss. Perform some concrete act. Number 9 I have called simply, try a bit of one-on-one. Action is a symbol of living. While we perform concrete acts for our grieving friend, we do not wrap him or her in cotton wool and sit there on the sidelines as an observer of us living out their life for them. Oh no, by swinging into action with your friend, whether at his hobby, his work, sport, whatever, you help build a bridge into the future. Perhaps it means painting the garage with him, or weeding the garden, or spending an afternoon with the woman friend mending the children's clothes, or browsing through antique shops. Genevieve Davis Ginsburg, in her excellent book To Live Again, Rebuilding Your Life After You Have Become a Widow, she relates the following story. One pastor visiting a man whose son had died knew his hobby was restoring furniture. "Come on," he said, "let's go down to the basement." They sanded a table together. Later the man said, "This was the first time I felt I could go on living." Sorrowing people tend to drop out of things. They're often like a rider thrown down from a horse. If they are to ride again, better to get back onto the horse quickly. Number 10 is to reach out for others. Once you have your friend doing things for himself, his grief is nearly cured. But once you have him doing things for other people, then he is cured. Volunteer work for charity, enrollment in a community group to help young people, committee work at church, all ways of getting people out of themselves and back into active life. Service is a great antidote for self-pity. It takes thoughts off oneself, but more important, it helps the person find an opportunity to invest himself or herself into others and find meaning in life. Everywhere there are people facing loss, and this is better handled when there are people around like you who, although they may not have all the answers, are able to make it evident that they love and care. Now we're going to stop and have another discussion time, and we're going to spend a few moments sharing about times of loss, not just bereavement, where you got help from and what hindered you from doing your grieving effectively. We're going to move to the group of small and then, if you bear with me for a few minutes longer, we will look at another example from the Christian perspective. Let's look briefly at the way God helped the prophet Elijah to cope with the time of discouragement and depression. I believe it can be of value to look at this incident as a way of summing up the things that we've so far considered. The story is found in 1 Kings chapter 19. If you know the story, you'll recall that Elijah became very disconsolate and discouraged when he failed in his ministry and fled 140 kilometers from the anger of Queen Jezebel. The queen was seeking his life, you may recall, in recompense for the lives of the prophets that Elijah had slain. While he was fleeing for his life, an angel comforted him with food and an opportunity to air to God his feelings and concerns. He even begged God to take away his life. Now, for those familiar with this story, notice how God, through the angel of the Lord, dealt with Elijah's problems. He focused on Elijah's physical needs. Elijah was given food and drink and a chance to rest. Secondly, he was given a chance to get things off his chest, so to speak. Talking, as we've seen, is therapeutic. The more Elijah talked, the more he aired his problem and so brought about a release of his emotions. And thirdly, the Lord said about challenging and redirecting Elijah's thinking, showing him that he was not alone nor in danger of death. Elijah's problem was twofold. He was overstretched, hence the food and the drink and the rest, and he was the victim of wrong thinking. The Lord taught him to think differently, a basic principle in effective caring. And before long, Elijah was back in contact with people, free from his doubt and his depression. The angel of the Lord in this story represents a good model for our caring for grieving people around us. We must encourage people to get physical help if they need it, urge them to express their feelings, and help them to think more clearly and more in line with what God thinks. And such a ministry is not reserved for angels. It can become your ministry too. Well, that draws to a close our practical help for the grieving. But before we have our question time, I promised you that we would mention some self-help suggestions for grieving people, if you are grieving. As I mentioned earlier, grief has many causes, but all these stem from the emotional response to loss. Grief comes from the Latin word gravis, meaning heavy. Of course, this is how our emotions feel when we are grieving. It might be loss of esteem, a material loss. You know, if you've been robbed, you suddenly feel you've lost everything that was sacrosanct, everything that was sacred. You feel that exposure. Loss through death, especially suicide or a child or terminally ill. It may be the loss of relationship, divorce or separation. It might be the loss of progeny through hysterectomy or menopause. It might be the loss of status through employment or demotion. Might be the loss of freedom through incarceration. Might be the loss of dignity through old age. Helping yourself through grieving is an awesome task, it seems. But a fear that is faced is the only fear that can be overcome. Just as we think there is no cure for death or loss, and there isn't, there is no cure to put circumstances back the way they were before. And just as there's no correct way to survive traumatic loss, there is no such thing as a simple self-help road to recovery. I have two suggestions to make here for the grieving. One you will find in a handout from Pam Ludwishi, The Signs of the Times. Pam is with her husband, counsellors at the Sydney Adventist Hospital. And the handout is entitled Coping with Grief. Also, I would like to suggest that we look at the list that I've got here on the overhead. Firstly, before I say these, I might just mention that these are only suggestions. These have come through my years of experience in working with grieving people, and I'm fully aware that these are all easily said and that none are easily done. So let's look through our list. Number one, take your feelings seriously. Allow yourself to experience them to the full. Study and learn how to deal with anger, guilt, frustration, depression appropriately. After the Newcastle earthquake, I counselled and debriefed counsellors, and I suggested they promote the philosophy that nothing can change the past, your choices can steer the present, and you can control the future. Our hearts condemn us when our emotions overpower our intellect. We respond to situation on the basis of how we feel rather than relying on what we know. When our hearts condemn us, we allow our emotions to get behind the wheel. Our intellects are thrown into the back seat. When this happens, we must remember two things. The first is, God is greater than our hearts. The second is, He knows everything. And that's why we live by what God says and not by how we feel. Feelings can be both a help and a hindrance in the Christian life. When you are having a mountaintop experience, the emotion of praise and joy can be absolutely wonderful, a thrilling, inspiring sense of God's presence that uplifts and sustains. But when you're down in the valley, the negative feelings can lead to spiritual discouragement and depression. Like David in the Psalms, we need to call to mind what we know to be true and trust in God, however we might feel. Nevertheless, we must take these feelings seriously. Secondly, we need to listen to our body clock. Grief is not a phase, but a process which takes place in the fullness of time, your time. There's no set time for grieving. Different cultures have different expectations. Jews, for example, would recommend 1 week. Asians would recommend an entire year. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I believe any expectation is unrealistic. Grieving is such a personal experience that the Creator has endowed each individual with our own body clock. What may take one person a matter of weeks or months will undoubtedly take another many years. Thirdly, medications that hide pain will not allow you to experience pain's healing. Just as you accept the hurt and the suffering, try also to accept the caring of others. Just as you learn to let the grief out, learn to let your friends in. Invite their help when you need it. Some may try to bulldoze your grief away, but this is just their way of coping or trying to be of help. It's not reasonable to expect them to understand everything. And number four, don't expect too much of yourself. Don't be afraid to pamper and praise yourself occasionally. I have another handout for you. An ABC of coping strategies. These are by Peter Bamford of the University of Newcastle. A light-hearted contribution to becoming an unstressed person. And number five, feel sorry for yourself sometimes. One form of depression is caused when people believe that feeling sorry for themselves is sinful. A book I mentioned earlier by Genevieve Davis Ginsberg, she says on page 25 of that book, "For no convincing reason, self-pity is judged to be the worst of possible sins. On the other hand, self-pity is actually more desirable than other people's pity, and feels pretty good when you're just plain tired of coping. Feeling sorry for yourself is like putting your emotional feet up, resting between coping bouts and catching a second wind." Overdone, of course. It can be a bore for everyone. Number six on our list is to have a plan for each day. One task, one goal, one day at a time. Some people find it especially helpful to plan out the next day immediately before retiring to bed, which helps not only the next day, but also helps sleep to come a little more easily, knowing you're doing something positive for yourself. Your plan should be for yourself, S-E-L-F. S for simple, E for extending to others, B, L for a little bit demanding, and F for flexible. In your plan, budget for doing a little something for yourself, as well as a little something for somebody else. Putting yesterday's frustrations into tomorrow's program is to you a pair of crutches. Just plain busyness is a sling. Self or work absorption is a band-aid, but pre-planned activity is healing. Another quote from Ginsberg, and although she's writing for widows, we can easily substitute our own circumstance for the situation. She says, "Make a weekly trip to the library for such light reading as mysteries, biographies, and inspirational books. Check the newspapers daily for events and activities open to the public, art, music, politics. The subject is not so important as being out with people and exposing yourself to something new and possibly challenging. Collect information on investment. Attend investment seminars, but without making a promise or commitment. Enroll in an exercise class suited to your physical capabilities and not those of a 16-year-old ballerina." One woman told me that she wanted to be like a 16-year-old. In fact, she asked God the night before she went to sleep that the next morning she would wake up with the complexion of a 16-year-old and woke up the next morning covered in pimples. So we need our exercise to be suited to our physical capacities and capabilities, not to those of a 16-year-old ballerina. We also need to set a time each week for bookkeeping and business-related errands so that we're never overly occupied with the job or remiss. Ginsberg also says we should start in investigating and collecting information about classes, volunteer jobs, hobbies, training. If you're a homemaker, widow, find opportunities for employment. Make no choices if you're still feeling confused and preoccupied. Likewise, don't commit yourself to start work or return to work until you're ready, she says. Throughout her book also, she encourages widows and those grieving to join a weekly support group if one is available. She suggests too that we get out and mingle with people, but to do it with purpose. If we go to the park, we should feed the birds. If we go shopping, we should have a specific purpose in mind. We could also make an appointment to have lunch or dinner with a friend, maybe once a week, or more often if we're a working person who has to maintain a facade You need to let your hair down. She also suggests avoiding committing ourselves to any program that involves concentration or taking care of sick people unless we can handle it. She says you may be too distracted to keep your mind clear and too vulnerable to handle illness and death. Choose upbeat, short-term, interesting projects at the beginning, as you're less likely to withdraw and feel a failure. Avoid taking babysitting your grandchildren if it means you will be alone with them for long stretches. Visits, for sure, but be free to leave when it feels right. And finally, Genevieve suggests taping this sign to your bathroom mirror where you can't fail to see it every night. Don't go to sleep without a plan in your head for the day ahead. Number 7 is to use visualization. Fantasize the activities in your plan for tomorrow being entered into with peace and serenity, with interest and with ease. Number 8. Share your learnings and your experience to minister to others who also are grieving, maybe with a support group, or with another widow if you're a widow, a divorcee if you're a divorcee, a victim of crime or earthquake or fire or employment, or the loss of a limb, whatever, with somebody who's had a similar loss. Number 9. Start a diary if you don't already have one. We counsellors usually choose to call it a journal, for it logs the journey to recovery rather than recording grief. You may sprinkle the pages with tears, but saturate the pages with past memories, victories, high points of the past and of this day. Number 10, write down your if-onlys on a separate page of your journal to be dealt with in calm rationalisation at a later date or with a professional counsellor. Very rarely are if-onlys healing in themselves, but journaling them enables us to see their illogicity, how illogical they are. When you look back over your list, gradually eliminate the most illogical first and pray over and share with an empathising friend if there's any left. Unless you morbidly choose to be self-destructive, never accept an if-only at face value. It's too soul-destroying. Never be afraid to seek the support, number 11. Never be afraid to seek the support and understanding of a trained counsellor, rabbi, pastor, priest, lifeline. And this becomes imperative if you ever feel self-destructive or you feel you want to hurt yourself in any way. And number 12, actively seek inspiration, strength, hope, courage, and comfort through faith in God. Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.